So does anybody call you Samantha?
Only people who want to get a dirty look.
Really?
It's really only used when I'm in trouble. So, you know, if you're my friend, you know better.
I see. Well, welcome to wherever you are. My name is Ryan McNeil in Toronto, Canada, and you are listening to episode 90 of the Matinee Cast. It's the movie-loving podcast of my movie-loving website, thematinee.ca, your home for cinematic passion and perspective. Dear friends, you might hear a slightly different timbre to my voice, and that is because it is very early, and I am talking so early to you folks because my guest has staying up quite late to do this show. We are back across the wire talking to a guest I've been wanting to get on the show for quite some time, and we just needed to find the right movie that was playing both in Canada and in Australia at the same time, and finally this opportunity has presented itself. She is one half of who I like to call the first couple of Australian film going. Her other half was on the show many moons ago to talk Avengers, so I'm probably overdue to get him back, but today we have the writer and editor of an online universe, a site you can find at anonlineuniverse.com. We are across a wire to Sydney, Australia. Please welcome Sam McCosh to the show. How are you this morning? This evening, I should say.
But I'm good, Ryan. How are you?
I'm failing already, apparently, so I should be okay by the time this episode wraps. On episode 89, we'll be discussing Only God Forgives. We'll be taking listener feedback on Blind Watches and turn the record over to Play the Other Side. Before that, though, we need to learn more about Sam. This is Know Your Enemy. Okay, Sam, you've listened to the show plenty of times. You know how this goes. What was the first film you could remember seeing in a theater?
Well, the first film I remember is Beauty and the Beast, although my parents claim the first film I actually saw was The Little Mermaid.
So not very far apart, but it's kind of funny that Little Mermaid made no impression on you.
Well, I would have only been four when it came out, so... I don't know why I don't remember it.
I thought you were going to say that you had like an aversion of fish or something.
No.
Do you remember anything about the actual experience of going to see Beauty and the Beast? Like anything about the theater or who took you or
it was a beautiful theater that no longer exists in my hometown. It's actually a parking lot for one of those horrible children's indoor play centers.
Oh, no.
Now, which is quite upsetting. And I do remember that I was allowed to get these lollies we have that are called Snifters, and they're like a mint center with chocolate on the outside and then a crunchy sort of shell to them. And I remember feeling so grown up that I was finally allowed to have these special sweets that you only have at the movies.
That's awesome. And obviously you must have loved the movie.
Yeah, I mean, I was... you know, caught up by it. I wanted to be a princess. I wanted cutlery that danced around my lounge. Of course, that never happened, but it was a lovely dream.
That would be so disheartening if you know, you're, I guess by that point you would have been six, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're 6 years old and you're always looking at your household items, waiting for them to start singing.
Yeah, it just never happened, but thankfully I moved on to a next Disney film and promptly forgot about that one, I'm sure.
That's good. What was the last film you watched?
I rewatched This Is the End, which just came out in cinemas here this week. You know, I really actually had a lot of fun with it. These sort of films, I usually find that they have a few too many genital jokes for my liking. But there was something about the way that the actors sort of made fun of themselves, or at least of what they believe people think about them, that was quite refreshing. And, you know, I had quite a good time with it.
Yeah. It's funny because a lot of the things that... a lot of the things that you're saying that you're digging about it, I wasn't so crazy about it. I like you, I kind of thought there was a few too many dick jokes in the movie, including towards the end where we get possibly the largest one I've ever seen on a screen. And I've seen Shame. That feeling of them playing off their own characters, I almost feel like it was an idea they had at a party one night, like when they were all off by themselves. They're like, hey, this would be a great movie, we should write this. And that the conversation of hearing them come up with the idea was probably better than the actual idea. But at the same time, it's comedy, right? So it did make me laugh. So I guess that's really the measure of it. If it makes you, it either works or it doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, I laughed a lot more in this than most comedies I've seen this year, although I do feel it was too long. It really should have been 90 minutes. I did sort of get a little bit tired in the middle, thinking, get out of that house already and do something. But yeah, it was pretty good.
And you just said you went to see it again, right? So like, this was a two-timer for you?
Yeah, so I was lucky to see it the first time at a media screening that Seth Rogen actually attended, which was pretty cool. And then I went and saw it again with Andrew when it came out in cinemas.
What's one of the worst films you've ever seen?
Well, I try and not remember those sort of films, but
as we all.
One that's annoyed me this year is Olympus Has Fallen. I really hated that film.
I didn't catch that. Why did you hate it so much?
It felt like the characters had picked up a book of 80s action thriller cliches and had been told to read them in the most unbelievable wooden way possible.
Oh no.
I just couldn't stop groaning, and there was just this level of gratuitous violence throughout the film which really left a bad taste in my mouth. And I was like, you know, at times it was trying to be funny, and then it was like slapping women around, and I was kind of like, what is going on here? It just didn't work for me. It was a mess.
Oh god. Did White House Down make it over there yet?
No, it's got a release, I think, September.
Oh, okay. Because, like, I guess it can't get much worse, right?
I would hope not. At least Channing Tatum and is it Jamie Foxx?
Yeah.
The other actor? They are, both of them combined, about 20 times better than Gerard Butler, in my opinion.
Wow. I don't think I've ever had somebody say a movie so recent as one of the worst ones they've ever seen. So that's a real deep condemnation. I like that.
Really don't like that film.
What is a classic or essential film that you've never seen?
And most of my friends know this about me, but it's still, you know, hard to say out loud. I've never watched a single Star Wars film.
Wow. Wow. Well, you're actually not the first guest to say that. Somebody else mentioned that they've never seen one of the original Star Wars films, so I do apologize to whoever that was that I can't remember off the top of my head, but you have company. How does that happen? It feels to me that they're all on TV all the time, and, you know, of course there's like DVDs and videos floating around like crazy. Is it just like not your thing, or is it just something you've never, like, you're interested in, but you've never made the time for?
Well, I mean, I've tried to watch bits of the fourth and fifth films from the original trilogy a few times, but my interest just waned. And then I was kind of like, these films are so important in pop culture. How can they ever stand up to the lofty position that people have put them in? And I'm not sure they ever can, so maybe I'd rather not know that than be disappointed by it.
Huh. See, I think that what it is it's like from the time that they happen, like a lot of the people who write and who do podcasts and that kind of thing and who are critics are largely of a certain age and older. So they were around when these films were like the phenomenon, and everything since then, including the new three films, always springboarded off that. So it might be because you're younger than me, and you're obviously younger than like that era of film going. It might just be that it wasn't as important to your generation of filmgoers.
I think, yeah, I just maybe just missed the cutoff a bit. And my parents, although they love movies, they never really pushed Star Wars on me. It's not like I had a geeky father going, you must watch this or I'm disowning you. So, I just never got around to it. And now I'm kind of half made the decision not to watch them, unless I can be convinced otherwise.
Well, you got to remember, we're getting new films starting like next year, right? Or the year after.
Yeah, I'm already bored of the conversation on Twitter.
Last but not least, what's a film that for any reason you wish you'd made?
So I'm going to go with a documentary from 1996, and it's The Paradise Lost, The Child Murders at Robin Hills.
Okay.
Which I think is one of the most profound documentaries I've ever seen. And the attention that this documentary got from, you know, it got celebrities and people with money on board to the case of these young men, and ultimately it was this film that started this movement, which ended with them getting released from prison where they had been held for wrongfully charged for the murder of three young boys.
Wow. I think in 90 episodes, you're the first person to say a documentary.
Wow, okay.
It's got me speechless too. That is a great choice. I haven't seen that one. I've seen the third one, which does recap a little bit of what happened in part one. Of course, I'm very well aware of the movement, but it's one of those documentaries that I've meant to see for the longest time. And yeah, you're right, because it's kind of like, I think The Thin Blue Line was another one of those documentaries which really, really altered public perception of a case. Mm-hmm. You know, there have been a few like that where they alter public perception of something. But it's very, very rare where a film can be made that alters, alters the law really in a part of the world. So no, that's a great choice. And now, as I said, now you're making me feel kind of ashamed that I've never seen it.
I mean, yeah, I really recommend it. It horrified me. Like, I was yelling at the TV going, what is going on? How can this be happening? It's just outrageous. And the three documentaries together are amazing. And then we have the West of Memphis, which is separate from these three, but does a really good job of wrapping up a lot of the coverage, plus goes into more depth about the sort of journey to gather the evidence that eventually got them out. So those four films together make for a really interesting look into a quite high-profile criminal case.
Well said. Well, there we go. That's lots about Sam, and as I said, certainly illuminating things that I never knew. Your chance to come talk to me happens right after this, so come on back.
Why are you shaking like a leaf? Come on, come talk to me.
Last episode, I asked people about a film that they had just seen on somebody's recommendation. I'm kind of always interested in, tastemakers, for lack of a better term, because, we all go to movies for our various reasons. We have lists or something looks good or that kind of thing. But every once in a while, I like it when somebody says, just watch this, you know, and you find yourself really, really enjoying what you see, or, you know, possibly not liking what you see, as the case may be. And I got some good responses on Facebook. My friend Sue Maynard said Monkey Business, which is a screwball comedy starring Cary Grant and Ginger Rogers. She's saying Monkey Business because I suggested that to her 2 weeks ago. I told her, hey, there's this cool movie on Netflix, just watch it. And she watched it and really, really enjoyed it. So thanks for that, Sue. Nick Hat Zara of Across the Universe podcast and Being Norma Jean said, Emily, I actually thought I would hate it. This was when I wasn't a big fan of foreign movies. And now it's number 7 on my all-time favorite list. A school friend recommended it to me. Oh, she was the one who introduced me to the Sex Pistols. So I thought I should listen to her. I guess that's kind of one of those things. If you think a person just has good taste in general, you're more likely to listen to them, right?
Yeah, I mean, you think, oh, well, they've told me about this and I liked it, so why not? I'll give it a go. Less of a risk, right?
Exactly. Simon Collum in England was not so fortunate. He mentioned You, Me, and Everyone We Know. He said, and it's shit. Pretentious.
Ouch.
Yeah. Pretentious, pseudo-intelligent trite. His brother suggested it to him. Apparently, his brother sold it as something like Little Miss Sunshine, Garden State, etc., and it's not. I haven't seen... Did you see that one, You, Me, and Everyone We Know?
No, I heard so many people say things along a similar line, so I never got around to watching that one.
They can't all be winners, right? Jess Rogers in upstate New York watched Peacock, based almost exclusively on her co-host Rachel Thoreau's recommendation, and she loved its weirdness. I still haven't seen that. That's the one... Have you seen that one that's with Cillian Murphy?
I've never even heard of it.
Okay, they both love it, and I think it's got both Cillian Murphy and Ellen Page in it, if I remember correct. But yeah, it's one that I've been meaning to catch up with. This one made me laugh. Courtney Small from Big Thoughts from a Small Mind said The FP, which I can only surmise that he was suggested by myself and Andrew G-Man Robinson on a recent episode of the Matinee Cast. Courtney was not a fan, and I don't blame him because it's a very, very silly movie. Colin Biggs, who writes Nevermind Pop Film, said that he watched Primer based on little more than its title. Have you ever done that? Have you ever thought, here's a film called X and thought, I must watch this?
Not that I can think of, but Primer is one that I've also watched just blindly on a recommendation, and it gave me a brain headache.
Yeah, I remember I actually had to really, really do a lot of homework about that one afterwards to see if I could totally follow everything that had happened.
There's a really great flow chart somewhere online that sort of lists all the different timelines, and I was reading it and I was like, wow, I really missed like 90% of this film.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. That was, I think I might need to look that and give it another watch. On the website, I got some comments there. Sean Kelly, who writes SK on Movies, said there was actually a bit of a double whammy at this year's Hot Docs Film Festival, thanks to the blogger community here in Toronto. It was on opening weekend of the festival when local writer Kurt Haviland wrote on his Facebook, "God damn, everyone needs to make room for Valentine Road at Hot Docs or when it plays later this year on HBO. He believes that I was singing the film's praises as well. That's true. And it was enough for him to check out the next screening. At that Valentine Road screening, I ran into both Kurt Haviland and Courtney Small, who both had just seen Maiden Trip, which I also subsequently checked out. And let's just say that both films were in my top three of the festival." Now, that actually brings up a good point, because you every year do the Sydney International Film Festival. Have you come across that when you're doing a fest, like either in the run-up or during, somebody will say, "Hey, I was really interested in this," and you end up making time, trying to make time for it?
Yeah, I mean, especially beforehand, we have a tendency to share our schedules on Twitter or Facebook or whatnot. And if I see three or four people have the same film on their schedule that I've overlooked, I have a tendency to rethink my schedule.
Ah, you're a follower.
Oh, yeah. When I know that people, you know, are intelligent and knowledgeable and have been to more of these festivals than me, I definitely take note of what they're saying.
I see. The only thing about that is you can go nuts trying to do that. Like, you know, I'll sit down, I'll make my schedule, and I'll try and keep aware. And if I've got a window, I'll fill the window. But to totally reshuffle things after you've got it set, that can really, really make for a lot of headaches.
Yeah, I tend to only completely reshuffle if there's a late edition, which the Sydney Film Fest quite often does, because it follows pretty much directly after Cannes. So they usually have a couple of late Cannes films that get popped in.
Oh, cool.
And that is awesome, but also, yeah, really headache-inducing.
Yeah, well, and I'm gonna be starting up that headache soon, because the titles for TIFF start getting announced this week. Jessica at the Velvet Cafe in Sweden. Jessica said, "When I wrote an enthusiastic review about Buried, I got comments on my blog from three readers, Pete, Rodney Teltree, and Kara, who all pointed me towards the Canadian movie Cube. I really didn't know a lot about it before watching it, and I trusted my blog readers, as always." That can be a daunting position. After all this time, they know my preferences. As you know, at the episode of the Matinee Cast where I appeared, I fell in love with it, and actually I loved it so much that I successfully campaigned for it to be included as a screening at my local film club. Don't underestimate the influence that the blogosphere may have on what will eventually appear on the big screen. All of us, we do well to get comments and get us pointed in all sorts of directions, because there's so many films out there that it can, you know, just getting some guidance on that can be really, really daunting. And I really love, that's the one thing I really like about having a comment section, is a lot of the times it can be, if you like this, you might like this.
I tend to think bloggers and friends are more reliable than Netflix's recommendation algorithm.
That's for sure. Dan Heaton, the public transportation snob, said it's tough as a blogger to go into movies knowing nothing beyond a recommendation. That's true. That did happen when my brother recommended that I watch Uncle Boonmi, Who Can Recall His Past Lives. A few years ago, it was showing here at the local college film series, and I knew very little about it. I was a bit sleepy watching it because of the laid-back tone and gorgeous scenery, but it was also mesmerizing. I still haven't seen Uncle Boonmi. Have you seen Uncle Boonmi?
No, it's one that a lot of people have commented that they enjoy, but I've just never got around to that one.
Yeah, I'm of the same thing. One of the names who's been mentioned a few times here, Kurt Haviland. I know he loves that movie, and I just haven't got around to it. So I think one of these days I'm going to have to finally pull the trigger. On Twitter, I got a few responses as well. Anna, the movie nut, said that Alex Withrow, who tweets as Shifting Persona, does that often for me with his various lists. So such examples include Roger Dodger and The Fire Within. Not to be outdone, Alex Withrow then tweeted himself, and he said he watched Gimme the Loot recently because a film friend thought I'd like it. He was right. It's a cool little flick.
That's a great film, actually. I watched it last night.
Gimme the Loot. What's it about?
It's about a couple of New York teenagers who are sort of taggers, graffiti artists, and they have a dream to tag the apple that comes out of the stadium when the New York Mets hit a home run.
Okay.
And it's just sort of about, it's set over a few days, and it's about their mission to try and get enough money together to bribe someone they know that works at the stadium to let them in. And it's very, very funny.
I need to see this. I'm going to be chasing this down for sure. That sounds right up my alley. Awesome. Thank you for that. Both you and thank you, Alex. Stevie Taylor in New Zealand said The Iron Giant, which is another one I recommended to her. So everybody's pointing at me for making blind recommendations today. She says, I sure loved it, even if it took me ages to get around to finally watching it. I know I recommended she watch it when she appeared on this podcast, which was almost a year ago. And I know I think a few months went by before she finally tracked it down, which caused me great amusement because she, at the time, she was working in a video store.
It shouldn't have been that hard, Stevie.
Exactly, that's what I'm saying. Not to make too much fun of Stevie. We love Stevie here. Andrew Robinson, the G-Man, said, Fish Story, perfect brilliance of movie making. And he thinks it was suggested to him by, he wanted to use the internet as a whole. He thinks he first heard of it through Adam Quigley on the Slash Filmcast. I cannot even remember what Fish Story is about. Bubba Wheat, who writes Flights, Tights, and Movie Nights and hosts the Film Wise podcast, says he can't think of any specific examples, but many movies I've watched for my site slash podcast completely blind and loved. The format of Bubba's site is what allows him to do this. Like, he's put up a list on Letterboxd saying, here are famous movies that I've never watched. And he gets his guests to go through that list and pick one, saying, you must see this one for sure. And then they talk about it and they talk about another film. So it's kind of funny because he's putting up his, you know, what needs to be done and just relying on people to drive him towards a certain title.
That's kind of an interesting way of doing it. I mean, yeah, we've all got these lists and it's hard to get through them. So I guess that's one way of, you know, making sure you do.
Yep. That'll do it. So you're up, Sam. You said you had a few, what are some of the titles that people have recommended to you and you sat down and just watched?
One that I saw just a couple of weeks ago was Terrence Malick's latest film, To the Wonder, which I had no intention of seeing and didn't know anything about. But Simon, who runs a site and a podcast called The Last Podcast Show out of Melbourne in Australia, wrote a 5-star review of it. And I thought, okay, I have to see this. And yeah, I loved it.
Really? To be fair, I need to see it again. I saw it the one time, and it was in the middle of a film festival, which I'm not always at my critical best, shall we say. I remember being unimpressed. I remember thinking it was pretty, 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 but I was not that crazy about the actual story. Now, I think I need to go back and take another look at it. And you said, you know, do you like Malick you've seen everything else or a bit of it?
I've only seen a few of his films, and The Tree of Life, the first time I saw it, I hated it. I thought it was a Natural Geographic screensaver. And I was really bored, but then I rewatched it and I thought, okay, there's something here, but you know, when this film was announced, I kind of just dismissed it and didn't think anything of it. But I'm so glad I saw it because I just thought it was really beautiful and it was quite accessible and it was just this lovely exploration of the different types of faith and how faith is tested. And I don't know, it really spoke to me. Maybe it was just the mood I was in on that day. Maybe on a different day it would have frustrated me, but on that day it really worked.
Not bad. What else you got?
One that Andrew recommended to me was A Man Escaped by Robert Bresson.
Oh, yeah.
Which he just was just like, what? You haven't seen this? And promptly bought the DVD over, which I watched and was like, blown away by. It was such an amazing film. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah, no, that one, I actually got lucky enough to see a screening of that a little more than a year ago, and it was kind of a similar situation. Two of my local friends used to do a preview of our local Cinematheque, the Lightbox. They would do a preview of whatever was coming up on their season. and go through it and suggest some stuff on they used to do videos, and that they mentioned, like, I had no interest in any of the Bresson films that were coming through, but they really underlined his films in the video. So I ended up seeing both that and Pickpocket. But yeah, it was great when somebody pointed me towards that film, and I couldn't believe that I was about to overlook it. Well, I have two myself. The first one would be when I first started blogging, when my site was The Dark of the Matinee over on Blogspot. I used to run a feature called With a Little Help from My Friends. And it was sort of this kind of idea where I got people to recommend me movies that they really loved, that they thought were kind of underappreciated or underseen, or they knew that I hadn't seen. And I didn't run it too many times. I think I only wrote about like three or four films. But one of them, though, that I remember that has stuck with me the most was Brick, which you've seen, I'm sure.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, as everybody has. I hadn't seen it at the time, of course. I don't think the Brothers Bloom, I don't think, had even come out yet, and certainly not Looper. And Rian Johnson wasn't really as widely known as he is now. So I hadn't seen Brick. I'd heard of it, but I hadn't even seen it. So when somebody said, here, just watch it, I'm not going to tell you anything about it, I just want to let it play for you. And I watched it, and I saw this noir film come out of the mouth of American teenagers, I was just knocked on my ass. And that was from a friend of mine named Krista, who was also a coworker of mine at the time. And obviously, yeah, if you can imagine not knowing anything about Brick before you sit down to watch it, and just watching that kind of beauty unspool, you know, you'd totally be caught unawares and just in for a great afternoon of watching.
That's a really good one.
It's kind of funny, like, of all the ones that were suggested to me for that very short-lived series, it's the one that I'm most thankful that somebody pointed me towards. Another one that actually I own now, and it's kind of a strange choice because it's not really my thing, but I really, really dug watching it, was my sister-in-law Paula has a knack. When like my birthday rolls around or Christmas rolls around, she'll buy me a movie that she thinks is awesome. And it's not necessarily one that's on any kind of my wish lists or any kind of like anything like that. She'll just kind of go off book and choose something for me that she loved. And she, I think it was like last Christmas, she bought me the Blu-ray of House of the Devil. Have you seen that?
No, not one I've seen.
So it's the first film by Ty West, who's the guy who did The Innkeepers. It's these two friends. One of them is played by Jocelyn Donahue. The other one's Greta Gerwig. And Donahue is just basically, she's kind of house-sitting this one night at this gigantic house just way off in the woods. And she starts to really get creeped out, and there's some really freaky shit going on at this house. But it's not like to look at like the box cover, and also just the title, House of the Devil, you'd think that it was like a slasher movie or something like that. But it's really, really tense and really, really kind of screws with your head. And the Blu-ray actually looks really, really awesome. The cool thing about it is that it came out in 2009. It's filmed like it's a late 1970s movie. So like the style of it and their clothes and everything like that, it's more in line with all of these like Halloween and that kind of movie.
Sounds creepy.
yeah, it is. It's really creepy. It's awesome. So yeah, so when Paula got me that one, that was another great movie that I hadn't seen that was just given to me and said, here, watch this, and I loved that. For the next episode, I think the next episode is going to be about Elysium, which of course is directed by Neil Blomkamp. And that got me thinking about new directors. So I'm thinking about directors who have like four features under their belt or less. And I want to know who people's favorite new directors are. So four films or less, who's your favorite director in that kind of category? And who knows, maybe I'll learn about more films that I haven't seen. Let me know. Ryan at the Matinee, Twitter, where I'm matinee_TA, or Facebook, facebook.com/darkmatinee. We will be right back after this with the new slang. And the new slang for episode 90 is only God for gives. Or this place. The night in Bangkok and the world's your oyster. Your walls are temples, but the pearls ain't free. You'll find a god in Only God Forgives is written and directed by Nicholas Winding Refn. It stars Kristen Scott Thomas, Ryan Gosling, Vithaya Pansagram, and Yaya Ying Ratha Fongam. It is a film about Julian. He runs a fight club in Thailand, and the whole thing is just a front for his drug running. One night, his sibling gets into a fight, and madness, and I do mean madness, unspools from there. Sam, you got to see this film a month or so ago at the Sydney International Film Festival. What did you think? Just in a general level.
I loved it.
Really?
I was really worried when I heard the reaction from Cannes, which was very divided, and it got booed, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. Some really great films have been booed at Cannes, but I was a bit nervous because the critics keep saying there's a lot of violence in this film, and I thought, oh, am I going to handle this? And then I watched it, and I was just blown away. I left the cinema shaking physically. It was just one of the most intense cinema experiences I've ever had. So, yeah.
Wow. I need to kind of diverge here. I need to sidebar. On my film going bucket list, I have Boo a Film at Cannes.
Would be really awesome.
Yeah, I feel, you know, I feel like that sounds like so much fun to boo a film at the Cannes Film Festival. Okay, so I was not moved to quite that extent when I saw it. I saw it just a few days ago because it finally came out over here. But like you, I think that the overreaction at Cannes was just that. I think that actually really helped the movie, because if I had a sat down hearing about how festival audiences loved and adored this film and just went nuts for it, I might have come away very, very different. But hearing that it was, let's be honest, this film was kind of loathed coming out of Cannes, even the divided reaction and what I was hearing from critics before it was released was a general disdain for this movie. And that actually really helped, because if anything, when I watched it, it helped me bring my reaction up rather than hearing how awesome it was and thinking, eh, it's not that great. So I like you, I really, really dug this movie. I think that there are some flaws to it. I think I'd like it less than you, because certainly I wasn't shaking coming away from it. But what was it? What was it that you loved so much about Only God Forgives?
It was just the whole atmosphere of the film was so tense, you know, like with the shadows and the darkness and this amazing score, and you know, there wasn't a lot of dialogue, and I think that really worked because you just watched these characters sort of walk around this world, and it was just, I felt so tense the entire film. And it wasn't the violence, you know, because if you've seen other Winding Refn films, particularly Valhalla Rising, which I think has the most in common with Only God Forgives, that has more violence in the first 5 minutes than the entirety of this film. It was the atmosphere that this film created. It was just like nothing that I've really experienced in a cinema before.
It's very red.
It is very red and very blue and pink and sometimes orange.
Yeah, but it seems like a weird point for me to make about a film, and I haven't actually written about it yet, so I might actually put that in my review, is that I feel like there's a lot of red in this movie that they're trying to kind of hammer us over the head with, you know, the whole idea of, you know, there's blood all around, and yet it's not really that bloody of a movie. Like the violence is all pretty swift.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the time you see something about to happen, but you don't actually see the event, or you see the aftermath. I think Winding Refn's been quite selective about what he's actually put on the screen.
Yeah. See, the funny thing for me was, one of the things that I wasn't so crazy about with this movie is, you're right, this is very, very evocative of The Pusher films, for sure, of Nicholas Winding Refn. I actually haven't seen Valhalla Rising. It's the only one of his films I haven't seen, and I kind of feel like I need to see it now just to kind of complete the set. And like you mentioned, I've heard before that it's really, really violent as well. It's about Vikings, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's about sort of very early religion, and it's, you know, the spiritual aspects between Only God Forgives and Valhalla Rising are quite similar, and there's not a lot of dialogue, and we have Mads Mikkelsen in the lead role, and he's playing a very sort of quiet, stoic, but terrifying character.
Well, now I'm definitely sold. I forgot that he was in it. But Only God Forgives, the thing that was putting me off a little bit is that it's very, very still, very quiet, and almost infatuated. Like, I'm thinking about a lot of those shots where Julian, that's Ryan Gosling, is, like, staring at his hands.
Yeah. I think some of it was a little indulgent. But a lot of those scenes where he was sort of staring off or looking at his hands, they sort of bled into dream sequences, or, you know, you didn't really know if it was happening or if he was just hallucinating or worrying or dreaming about things. So it kind of worked, but yeah, I do think a lot of it was there just to look pretty, but I thought it looked pretty, so I didn't mind so much.
Okay, well, that is fair. I'll grant you that. And that's the thing, is that, well, I thought it looked pretty. I like you, I was like, wait, is he dreaming? Is this a drug hallucination? What am I seeing? And I, you know, that happens kind of more than once. So I was getting a little bit shifty in my seat. However, and much of that, I should say, is really contained to the first 30 minutes. Once you hit the 30-minute mark, things tend to zip along pretty well. Because it's not even a long movie. It's like, what is it, like 100 minutes or so? 90 minutes?
It's like 92 minutes, yeah. 90 minutes. Yeah.
So that second hour, that last 60 minutes really, really flies. Namely, because around the 30-minute mark, Kristen Scott Thomas arrives as Julian's mom, named Crystal. And oh my dear God, is she amazing in this movie?
It's incredible, you know. From lately, most of the films she's in, she's playing the sort of matriarch or the proper French or English woman. So to see her like this was a bit like, what is happening?
Yes, she is a bombshell in this movie. The thing she says in this movie, I think I read somewhere that she was actually rather uncomfortable with what she had to say. And she's like, I'm going to do this, but I don't like it.
I don't blame her. I wouldn't say any of these things in front of polite company.
But when you're on your own, yeah, you totally say these things. She's diabolical. She is nasty. She really makes a bad situation worse in ways that we wouldn't expect. Again, it's the marriage of the actress and the character, because first of all, the character just comes along and really, really throws a stick of dynamite into the situation. But it's the way that we don't expect it to come out of Kristen Scott Thomas. Like, I mean, she was in The English Patient, for the love of God, right? You wouldn't expect her to. She's playing like almost like a.
She's playing white trash.
Yeah, yeah. If you've seen
the Versailles.
Yes,
one?
Yes. If you've seen the Queen of Versailles. Yeah, thank you. If you've seen,
she's totally that woman.
She is, and she's fantastic. So that was certainly one thing that kind of pulled up the movie. Was there anything that you noticed that either like really stuck out for you, something amazing, or maybe even something that kind of dropped the film back a bit for you?
Well, just got one of each. I mean, the thing that I probably loved the most was the score.
Okay.
If you took the score out of that film, it would have no life. The score was like the pulse. It kept my heart rate going. And I've listened to the score since, and just putting it on, it sort of gives me the chills. It was just something about the marriage of the Thai, traditional Thai music with the electronic sort of pulsing original music. I don't know. It just works so well.
Is it Cliff Martinez again?
Yeah, it is.
He's on a roll, man. Like I keep meaning to go back and listen to his score, even from Spring Breakers earlier this year, because that was an awesome score as well. And of course he did Drive, which we'll be talking about later on. The only thing about that score is I can't imagine just listening to it for kicks.
Give it a go, Ryan. You might be surprised. I quite enjoy it. And what I didn't like, although I agree Kristen Scott Thomas was fairly incredible, I thought her character was a bit much. In a film that was so quiet, she was like a tsunami of horrible noise, and it felt too much sometimes.
I love that, a tsunami of horrible noise. Yeah, I guess maybe that's where we differ, because as I said, that was where the film picked up for me was when that tsunami blew through. That was where all of a sudden I was really, really latched on to this whole path of destruction, really, almost literally, that she was leaving in her wake.
I mean, yeah, I can see that, but yeah, we'll have to disagree there. I think for me, she was the weakest point of the film, her character, not her performance.
Okay. Okay. I guess maybe because she was the part who I hadn't really seen in this kind of movie. Like I'd seen the cop, and I'd certainly seen the, you know, the expatriate who's in a land he doesn't totally belong in. And I'd seen the relationship between, you know, some guy and some lower class. I'd seen everything else. And I guess that was the one element in the story, the overbearing makes everything worse mother that I wasn't really used to. So I think that was why.
She was certainly different.
Yeah.
I'll give you that one, man.
Yeah. You know what the funny thing is about Only God Forgives, and it sounds strange to say that I like this, but so it's handsome. It is one of the most beautifully shot movies that anybody will see. But on the whole, it's also a dirty movie, and I don't mean dirty as in, like, you know, it's sex and you're going to feel ashamed or anything like that, but I mean it's this whole story and this whole world and these characters. They're grimy, they're greasy, they're really, really dingy. They remind me of the kind of characters and the kind of story we saw. Did you see Killer Joe?
Yes.
Same sort. I feel like these two movies would marry up very, very well.
Yeah, I mean, there's no one in this film really is redeeming.
No. Well,
you're not really supposed to like these people, right? I mean, the family are not very good people. They they're criminals. And then the police officer, he's corrupt and, you know, he's relentless. And I don't think anyone's really that likable. So, yeah, I agree with the Killer Joe comparison there.
Yeah. And it's all taken from this, you know, not, like, it's kind of funny because on the one hand, you're seeing these like beautiful, lavish rooms and these expensive clothes. And I'm thinking even of like the suit that Julian is wearing when he gets into that fist fight with the cop, which might be the most entertaining fight I've ever seen, just for how overmatched Julian is. You know, like that's the one thing I loved about that scene is you see them kind of circling each other and you think, oh, this is going to be badass. This is going to be like a really knockdown, back and forth kind of martial arts throwdown. And he just gets his ass handed to him.
Yeah, he's very outmatched by the man who walks around on the, you know, the riverfront or whatever it is, practicing his sword moves.
Yeah, no, it's great. But like, you know, the suit and the dresses and the rooms that they're in, it's all very, very expensive and high class. And yet it does nothing to bring up the morality of this story. So that's why I say it's a dirty movie. Like, I feel like if I had the DVD sitting on my desk, if I picked it up, there'd be a grease stain underneath it.
Yeah, I get that.
Yeah. Well, we end each review with a souvenir from the movie. So, Sam, if you could pick either an item or a shot or a line or anything, I think you kind of touched on it when you said it would be the score, and maybe that is your souvenir. What would be your souvenir from Only God Forgives?
Yeah, I mean, I have to take the score. It was the thing that really held the film together for me. So I love that score.
I promise you I will download it. Now, like, you've talked it up so much that I'm going to have to download it now.
I'm worried that it won't live up to the expectations that I've given it.
that's the risk that you run, right? Well, my souvenir, we didn't talk about him too much, but it would be the actor who plays the cop, Vithaya Pansagram. He is badass. He is so, so badass in this movie. He's stoic. He always means business. He doesn't dress very flashy. Like, he's dressed down most of the time. And he just kicks ass every time. And he, you know, he takes the mic and he sings karaoke once in a while. Any movie that this man is in from now on, I'm watching.
I'm with you there. He is terrifying. He believes he's God and they're his streets and these people have dared cross him and, yeah, get out of his way because the wrath is coming.
Yeah, you know what's kind of funny? There's a scene in this movie where he's chasing a hoodlum and yeah, you know, the hood kind of turns a corner after the cop has been, they call this cop the Angel of Vengeance, by the way. He turns a corner after the Angel has been like shooting at him. And I don't know about you, but before the Angel goes to turn the corner, he like throws his gun away. Like he just tosses it aside because I guess he's out of bullets. And in that moment, I was more afraid. I'm like, oh God, he doesn't even need his gun. What's he going to do?
I think that chase scene is my favorite part of the film. My heart was in my mouth because I'm like, this is not going to end well. It was pretty tense.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. Well, we do rate on the scale of 1 to 4 stars here on the Matinee Cast. So, Miss McCosh, which I will not call Samantha, what do you give Only God Forgives on a scale of 1 to 4?
A 3.5 out of 4 for me.
Wow. Yeah, you certainly did love it, didn't you?
Yep, I did, unashamedly, and I will defend it.
I had trouble with that first half hour, as I said, like the that kind of film at its most indulgent moment, and the fever dreams and the, that kind of moment. It was something of Winning's reference filmmaking. It's the part of his filmmaking that I like the least. So that dragged it down for me. So it's only a 2.5 for me, but it's a very enthusiastic 2.5. And it might actually climb with rewatch. I'll get to that in a minute. But it's definitely something that I think people should see, and certainly not a movie I'm going to forget anytime soon. And as I said, even just for The Angel of Death, it's a well done movie, but it's not without flaw. And I think you and I can both agree. We could both see how somebody would really hate this movie.
I totally understand why people wouldn't like it. And I guess that's what I really also enjoy about this film. I enjoy the discussion that it creates.
Yeah.
And the fact that you can see both sides. And it's not one of those blind sort of, no, how can you not love it sort of things. I really do get why people would hate this film.
Yeah,
but I hope they don't.
Yeah, and those kinds of movies are usually the ones that I say are the most interesting, and certainly the most interesting to, like you say, the most interesting to discuss. So there we go. 3.5 from Sam, 2.5 from me. Only God Forgives. It's in theaters now. I also think it's available on iTunes and on demand in certain places. So take a look around. You might be able to track down Only God Forgives sooner than you think. We will be back right after this with The Other Side. We're going to marry up this new film by Nicholas Winding Refn with a couple other offerings. So come back after this. So my choice for The Other Side to marry up with Only God Forgives, I ran with the Crystal character that Kristen Scott Thomas plays, and I wanted to find a film that marries up the idea of the diabolical mother. And I went all the way back to 1962, and I chose The Manchurian Candidate, which was directed by John Frankenheimer. Sam, you had never seen this film before, right?
No, I watched it especially for this podcast.
Hot diggity. Love when that happens. So very briefly, it's kind of about a political plot to drop an operative into America after he's been brainwashed while serving in Korea. And it stars a lot of great people. It stars Janet Leigh, it stars Frank Sinatra, it stars Angela Lansbury as the diabolical mother. So before we get into any of that, I'm curious, Miss McCosh, how did this movie play for you watching it for the first time?
I enjoyed it. I didn't love it, but I enjoyed the ideas, and I can't help but think, you know, when this film released, you know, and during the Cold War, it would have been really topical and played into people's fears that, you know, their neighbor was a communist, or, you know, whoever was suspicious looking could have been a communist. I think it would have been quite the film at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's true. Like as I was watching it, its pace feels strange, right?
It's a little bit disjointed, yeah.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny because when I watched it yesterday morning, and I kind of had in the back of my brain, I wonder how Sam's going to take to this. Like, have I just put her in for an afternoon of misery, or is it going to work very well? And I was trying to kind of divorce myself from everything I already knew about the movie. And, you know, I would say if somebody hasn't seen The Manchurian Candidate, be forewarned that it's very, very methodical in its pace. Like there's not really thrills aplenty in this movie.
It's worth watching, though, for me, for Lawrence Harvey alone, because he is dashing. What a handsome man, right? I have to say, Ryan. Yeah.
Well, it what kind of guy is it that takes away from Frank Sinatra in a 1962 movie?
Yeah, he totally shows him up. I mean, Sinatra's good, but Harvey was the star of this film.
Yeah. Now, as I said, the reason why I chose that as the double feature with Only God Forgives is because both movies have the diabolical mother, the diabolical matron character. And I thought that it seldom gets better than Angela Lansbury in this movie. When I was much younger, she used to be on a TV show here called Murder, She Wrote. Did you ever see any of those?
I've heard of it, but I haven't actually seen it.
Okay, so the funny thing about it is, she's playing it later, much later in life than she is in this movie, because it's like 25 years after this film was shot. And she's a very warm, intelligent mystery writer who then helps cops solve crimes. And I'm more used to seeing Angela Lansbury in that kind of role. So seeing her as this very almost like Lady Macbeth type woman really, really threw me. But how did you think that she measured up to what we'd seen Kristen Scott Thomas do in Only God Forgives?
Well, it seems like maybe if that's the sort of character she usually played, it was probably quite similar. I can imagine what you felt, you know, seeing Kristen Scott Thomas go from the proper English woman to this, the mother and Only God Forgives, must have been similar to the feeling you had.
Yeah.
Seeing Angela Lansbury, and she was pretty evil. I mean, not just to her children, but to her husband and to really the entire United States of America. So she probably tops Crystal in the evil stakes.
Well, where I kind of think that they were similar and you know, they're kind of running one and 1A on this is how they talk to people. Like, you know, there's a dinner scene in Only God Forgives where Crystal just says some tremendously awful things to Julian's, is she his girlfriend, or is she like, what would we call Mai in this movie?
His female
companion
interest.
Sure. Yeah, there we go. Yeah. Yeah. His lady interest. But Crystal says some truly, truly awful things to her. Now, don't get me wrong, Angela Lansbury in The Manchurian Candidate doesn't say anything nearly as vile. But the way she talks to her husband, who she's supposedly doing things to further his political career, she treats him like he's a child, and you're just listening to this woman going, oh my God, what is she doing?
Yeah, he doesn't have any balls, that man.
No. No.
She has locked them away and she commands him.
The one thing I was kind of struck with is if these were father figures acting this way, I don't think that we'd bat an eye. But for some reason, if a mother figure, it sounds tremendously sexist for me to say this out loud, but for a mother figure to act this way, it seems to throw everybody completely for a loop.
I mean, traditional conventions state that mothers be motherly and fathers be stern, you know? It was always watch out, wait till your father comes home.
Right.
Never the other way around. So, that's the way we've kind of been brought up traditionally. And I think it's just a little bit more shocking to see women act this way, especially towards their children or their partners.
Yeah. The other thing I noticed that kind of makes these, and I mentioned it a moment ago, that makes both these movies marry up very well is that beyond the mother figure, the daughter figure, or I guess in each case, I should say the daughter-in-law figure, tends to get mixed in the fray and get the short end of the stick in both situations. Not as much in Only God Forgives. And Only God Forgives, Mai is just subject to some pretty brutal verbal lashing. But in The Manchurian Candidate, Jocelyn gets mixed into this in a really, really unfortunate, and I don't know how it played for you, but for me, the first time I saw this, a really shocking way.
Yeah, I really did feel sadness for her, and it was obvious that, you know, the character, the mother, knew that the easiest way to get to her son was through his love interest, and she was a very unfortunate toy in her game, really.
Yeah. Yeah. She's collateral damage, but, it's brutal. You kind of like Jocelyn in the story of Manchurian Candidate. She gets the short shrift because her mother doesn't want her son to be with her political enemy's daughter. So she finds a way to really kind of manipulate him away from her. And then when they finally do reconcile and everything seems to be going well, she's disposed of in what at the time must have been, and still, a really, really shocking way.
It was very, very shocking. And I mean, Jocelyn's a very likable character. So unlike the characters in Only God Forgive, which you don't really feel too much for, you actually feel something for this girl. So it was far more of an emotional impact when she was played around with.
Yeah. Yeah.
As opposed to my and Only God Forgives.
Yeah. Did anything else jump out at you about the movie as you watched this for the first time this week?
It was just sort of the political feeling of this film rather than the character itself. I found the sort of hypnosis and the Queen of Diamonds thing to be quite interesting. And that's the aspect of the film I like the most, the way that this character was controlled. And yeah, it was quite interesting. And like I said, I can imagine at the time it would have been quite provocative.
Yeah, I always loved that trigger of the Queen of Diamonds, right? Like it's not just a keyword, although there is of course the keyword as well of why don't you pass the time with a little bit of solitaire. But the fact that one visual is the visual that really sets the wheels in motion. And they even say, kind of back to the reason why we chose this film, that the Queen of Diamonds was selected because of its resemblance to his mother.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's great. And it was a very clever tie-in. It's a very tight film, you know. Yeah. Everything sort of marries up very well, and things that appear to be a bit confusing in the beginning, by the end it all makes sense. So I did appreciate that about it.
Yeah. Well, I'm certainly glad that you liked it, because I would have felt really, really, I have had people watch some films that they weren't crazy about in the name of The Other Side. So I was definitely happy to hear that you dug the film. For me, the ultimate takeaway of The Manchurian Candidate is how relevant it still is. Like it's games of manipulation and of political tub thumping are still very, very relevant. Certainly North America, I imagine probably in Australia as well. Because it's all the Commonwealth, really, let's be honest. even as much as America has divorced themselves from the Commonwealth, it's still the same sort of games getting played. And maybe that's probably why it was remade a few years ago. Did you ever see the remake? I never did.
You know, I did, but I didn't actually remember I'd seen it until I watched this one. I'm like, oh, yeah, that was that really forgettable political thriller that I don't remember anything about because it was dull.
Right. I am kind of curious. Now that I've rewatched it again, this was probably the fifth or sixth time I've watched The Manchurian Candidate, although admittedly the first time in a few years. I'm kind of curious to watch the remake with Denzel Washington and see how it plays, because I think that a lot of these themes are still very, very relevant, and that you could probably tweak it a little bit and have some fun with you know, modern day setting. So I am curious to see that one. But there we go. Manchurian Candidate would be a good movie to move on to after watching Only God Forgives. And we've got one more choice, possibly the most obvious choice, as Sam's selection right after this. Sam's selection for The Other Side of Only God Forgives is the film that really got most people's attention pointed towards Nicholas Winding Refn 2 years ago in 2011. It is Drive, which also stars Ryan Gosling and stars, of course, Carey Mulligan and who am I forgetting? Oh, Albert
Ryan
Brooks.
Cranston.
How could I forget? Jeez, I'm forgetting all sorts of people. Albert Brooks and Ron Perlman. Which I'm sure most people of this podcast who are listening have seen Drive, so I'm not going to get too far into the plot. Sam, I get the impression that this is one of your favorite movies.
It is. It is for me, like you mentioned, for many others, the film that brought Winding Refn to my attention. And I'm not ashamed to admit, it's also the film that brought Ryan Gosling to my attention. Because before this film, the only Ryan Gosling film I'd seen was The Notebook, which is a film I hate so much, I didn't talk about it as the film I hate. And I refuse to watch Ryan Gosling films until Drive.
Okay, I kind of, you see, you're putting me at a disadvantage because I now feel the deep urge to derail this whole segment and just talk to you about The Notebook, but I feel like that would just take way too much time.
Really don't want to go there.
Oh, no, I do. I just think that's going to be a whole other show. So what is it about Drive then that has appealed to you so much that has made it like such a beloved film?
It starts from the first, when I saw it was New Zealand Film Festival closing night. It was snowing in central Wellington, which doesn't happen. So I walked to the cinema in the snow and you can actually hear the hail and the snow on the roof. And I just watched this film that I knew nothing about. I just known that it had picked up an award at Cannes. So I thought, okay, you know, I'll give this a watch. And wow, it just blew me away. It even blew one of the speakers in the cinemas out, because they had the sound out so loud. And it's just such a beautiful film, and it's so immaculately constructed, and just like the opening credits sequence, possibly the best thing I've seen in the last 5 years. I could just watch that over and over and over again.
Wow. See, you know what's funny is, like you, I came to this film during a film festival as well. This played at TIFF in 2011, and it was a rare thing where every once in a while a film will play at TIFF and then be released in regular theaters during TIFF's run. Like, it's almost like TIFF kind of serves as a North American premiere. And so in the middle of my festival, I actually took a moment, went to a regular theater and watched this for about half the price of a TIFF ticket. And I actually wasn't crazy about it. The first time I saw it, I thought, okay, it's really pretty. And my constant reaction to this day is, this movie is really cool. If somebody said to me, what is a cool movie, I point them towards Drive. But it never really latched on for me as something that was more than just a pretty cool movie, the way it did for others, including yourself.
I mean, yeah, it's definitely a cool film. But I think for me, I really got invested in Ryan Gosling's character. He reminded me of like a samurai who would come into a village, you know, things would happen and then he'd move on again. You didn't really know where he came from or where he was going. And I think I just really like the mystique about him.
Yeah.
I mean, well, we don't even know his name, right?
Right.
His driver. So,
which is, you know what? I was kind of waiting for that in Only God Forgives as well. Like, I think we don't even hear him called Julian until about 40 minutes into the movie. So I was like, does he have a name in this movie? For the love of God, tell me he has a name. But it's funny because my big takeaway from Drive, when I first saw it, I was kind of the stick in the mud while everybody was going gaga for Drive. I was the one saying, eh. My criticism of it was that it felt overly stylish, overly violent, and it had this sense of forced stoicism, which now that I see Only God Forgives, I was like, well, maybe I was a little hasty on Drive, because all of those criticisms are criticisms that I could apply to Only God Forgives like threefold, and Drive now kind of looks a lot better by comparison.
Yeah, I do think Drive is the better film. It's got a more coherent story. The characters are stronger. It's got about 20 times more dialogue.
Yeah.
So it's an easier watch for sure.
Yeah, and that's what I'm like. That was the thing. That was one of my, even when I was watching it this week, I was kind of yelling at my TV. Now, people can feel free to laugh at me about this, because as much as I'm kind of ragging on Drive, and I admit that I am right now, I own a copy. You know, I bought the Blu-ray. It's as much as I didn't like it, I still bought it. So when I was watching it this week, I was kind of yelling at my TV, all of those scenes where people don't talk to each other, they just kind of sit silently and stare. I was like, for the love of God, say something. And meanwhile, I go and watch Only God Forgives, and people say even less. and people stare even more.
But I think especially in Drive, it's the things left unspoken which are the most powerful. Like for me, the looks between Carey Mulligan and Ryan Gosling, particularly when Mulligan's husband comes back into the picture, just those looks say, you know, more than words could ever say.
Yeah, and we do get a lot of those looks, though, don't we?
Yeah, but, you know, there's obviously a lot of feelings.
Yeah, it's now you're tiptoeing back to some of the things that I didn't like about the film, because like I bet one of the scenes that I usually kind of like go get myself a snack when that part of the DVD comes up is the drive through the reservoir when Real Hero is playing.
Yeah, that's probably the weaker part of the film.
Yeah, okay, good.
It's a bit much, that song.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because it just, yeah. I was like, it feels like a commercial for something. I can't even think about what it would be an ad for, like maybe an ad for Ford, for his car or something like that. But now that, all that said, as much as I am done ragging on Drive, I think, the one thing that I thought really works well between, is that Nicholas Winning Refn has shown between these two movies, and certainly also with Pusher and Bronson, which we didn't even really talk about at all, is the man writes and creates some great villains. And you get that certainly, as we said, in Only God Forgives. And you get that here too, with Albert Brooks playing against type as Bernie Rose.
Yeah, he's great in this film, and much the same as when you saw Kristen Scott Thomas and you're like, what is she doing?
Yeah.
When you saw Albert Brooks in this, you're like, whoa. it was such a great surprise.
Was there anything else for you about Drive that really, really sticks out? Like something that you kind of go back to it about, or you use like as a touchstone about the movie?
I love just some of the choices he made, like Christina Hendricks, you know, she's quite a big name now, and she was in the film a really small amount of time.
Yep.
And I thought, you know, that was an interesting thing to do, just to keep her in there for that short amount of time. But that really shocked me when I saw the film, you know. And that's one, that particular scene, every time I see it, I'm still like, whoa, I can't believe that was how that was shot and how. Yeah, it still sort of gives me the chills.
Yeah, it's actually one of the things, the first time I saw the movie, that actually kind of really put me off, because I thought it almost kind of fetishizes that violence. And I was like, oh, I don't know that I needed to see that. But no, you're right. It still plays. I got to give it that. The only thing I kind of wonder after seeing Only God Forgives and rewatching Drive this week and thinking back on his other films is, I sort of wonder if Nicholas Winning Refn can do anything different. Setting Valhalla Rising aside, because I haven't seen it, he's done almost exclusively crime movies, and I kind of like to see him try something new.
Yeah, I would like him to do a different sort of genre, and also maybe something not quite so pretty. I'd like to see something a bit grittier.
Oh, no. I want him to make the films as pretty as he does. If I'm going to tell him to do something different, it's not going to be shoot it differently, because man, there are few people who can style a movie as well as this man and his team can. But you're right. I want to see a different type of story. I don't even know what kind of story I'd like. Like, I almost want to, part of me almost wants to see a war film from him, or part of me would actually kind of like to see a straight romance, like drop the crime element and see if you can play up the romance part, because I think he could probably do something good.
I think he knows how to, you know, get chemistry out of actors, so yeah, that could be interesting to see.
Yeah. So what would be your takeaway for Drive?
Drive is stylistically similar to Only God Forgives, and they, you know, they both have Ryan Gosling, and they both shot beautifully, but that's where the similarities end.
Yeah.
So don't go into Only God Forgives expecting Drive, because you're not going to get Drive too.
That is very well put. And you know what? When I saw this film, I got the impression that a lot of people in my theater were there because they were big fans of Drive. And I don't know if it was what they expected, because my theater was really quiet through this whole movie. So yeah, if you don't go see, or don't like get yourself set up to see Only God Forgives because you love Drive, because they're very, very different movies.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely stylistically Drive, and I'd say thematically more like Valhalla Rising. So yeah, don't think about Drive. Just go and see this film because it's an amazing director who's got a great vision. Like you said, no one shoots in quite like Winding Refn does, and that's reason enough to go and see Only God Forgives.
Well said. That is episode 90 of the Matinee Cast. Come on back on Monday, August 12th for episode 92, where we'll be talking about Neil Blomkamp's Elysium. There might be something else in between, but that still remains to be seen. Sam writes at an online universe. You can find that at anonlineuniverse.com. Do you have anything coming up that you want to plug?
Probably going to have reviews of like Josh Whedon's Much Ado About Nothing,
nice.
Which I loved. And I saw The Wolverine last week, so we'll have a review of that up too.
Oh, cool. Definitely look forward to both of those. And where can people find you if they want to follow you on Twitter?
You can find me tweeting far too much at Sakura_59.
Thank you for reminding me. What is Sakura?
It means cherry blossom in Japanese.
My site is thematinee.ca. For more podcast content, you can find back episodes by going to thematinee.ca/podcasting. You can also find them through using Listen, Apple's podcasting app, Stitcher Radio, Blueberry, and the iTunes Music Store. They all give you ways to subscribe for free and get alerts when new episodes drop. If you are in the iTunes Store, please do leave a review. I'd love to raise the profile of the show, and I do that through ratings and reviews, my Canadian listeners especially. Feedback on Only God Forgives, Drive, The Manchurian Candidate, or new talent, new directors who you love can be left in the comment section of the site. You can email me, ryan@thematinee.ca. You can go through Facebook, facebook.com/darkmatinee, or Twitter, where I'm matinee_ca. Sam, any final thoughts before I let you hit the hay?
Oh, just thanks for having me on, and I hope people get out and see Only God Forgives, because I want to have debates on Twitter with them about it.
Well said. I'm going to go back to bed because it is still far too early on a Sunday. For Sam, I'm Ryan. We'll see you at the matinee.